Last week we started a mini sub-series in our discussion on Habakkuk, and I want to go to the second part of that tonight. It's focused on Habakkuk chapter 1, verse number 12 and 13. So let's just read those verses again, just 12 and 13. O Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, we will not die, O Lord. You have appointed them to execute judgment. O Rock, you have ordained them to punish. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? Some of you may be familiar with the name of a gentleman called Peter Drucker. Peter Drucker was a writer and a modern-day management consultant, Austrian-born American gentleman who just passed away in 2005. And his penchant for management and management styles was such that he has been referred to on many occasions as the man who invented management. He was known by his passion for studying how human beings interact one with another, and in that interaction, how they organize himself or manage themselves in those types of relationships. Peter Drucker wrote a book entitled Managing in Turbulent Times. In it, he warned the Western world of coming times, which he characterized as irregular, non-linear, erratic times facing all of modern society. He also pointed out that at the end of World War II, the Western world experienced 25 years, a period of 25 years characterized as a time of high levels of continuity and uninterruptedness and great productivity in the Western world, while third world countries were at the same time beginning to emerge. He also says that that 25-year period of stability and continuity and productivity is being followed by an era of rapid change, which calls for new strategies which can anticipate the rapid change coming and still yet to come. And he calls that era following the original 25 years after World War II, he calls that era, this very time frame that you and I live in, a time of turbulence, and characterized it as extremely dangerous. And it echoes the description of an ancient prophet by the name of Habakkuk, of his own times and the circumstances that surrounded him. You see, God's favor upon Judah resulted from those original promises that God made to make of Israel a great nation in the very beginning. In addition to that, God's favor on Judah was the result of his favor upon one man, one individual, one king, and his name was Josiah. Also, during this particular time, the world political and military equation was changing very, very rapidly. The power of Assyria collapsed. An international political superpower status transferred to the land of Egypt. Judah became somewhat subordinate and dependent upon Egypt, and yet at the same time reached toward the east and developed a special relationships with Babylon, and especially the Chaldeans in the southern part of Babylon. And so sitting between these two superpowers, Judah as a nation felt some level of security and experienced some level of prosperity for a season. Those years became a similar period as those 25 years after World War II did for us of continuity and prosperity. Yet again, any prosperity that Judah was experiencing was due to God honoring Josiah and his faithfulness before the Lord. And in that atmosphere which developed of false security and actually false prosperity, Judah somewhat turned itself loose morally and every other way. And when the time came for Habakkuk the prophet to speak forth and to write forth, it resulted in the reality of what Habakkuk addresses in his very first lament. And notice that he uses words coming out of that period that ought to have been prosperous and stable. Instead, Habakkuk addresses it in terms of violence and injustice and wrongdoing, a justice system that had gone bad and was serving no one well. In fact, listen to 2 Kings chapter 22, verses 16 through 20, and God's message about this directly to Josiah. This is what the Lord says. I am going to bring disaster on this place and its people, according to everything written in the book the king of Judah has read. Because they have forsaken me and burned incense to other gods and aroused my anger by all the idols their hands have made, my anger will burn against this place and will not be quenched. Tell the king of Judah, meaning Josiah, who sent you to inquire of the Lord, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says concerning the words you heard. Because your heart was responsive, and you humbled yourself before the Lord when you heard what I have spoken against this place and its people, that they would become a curse and be laid waste. And because you tore your robes and wept in my presence, I also have heard you, declares the Lord. Therefore, listen to this now, therefore I will gather you to my ancestors, and you will be buried in peace. Your eyes, Josiah, will not see all the disaster I am going to bring on this place. So Habakkuk was not the first to hear the message of God's pending judgment. Even in this text, in 2 Kings, God is talking about his judgment upon Judah, but it would not break forth until good King Josiah is laid to rest safely in the arms of God. Now, since we took off last Wednesday, let's take a real quick look back and at least look at the sequence of this prophetic word coming from Habakkuk. Right on page one, if you'd let me say so, in the very beginning, Habakkuk addresses God with a strong lament over the widespread wickedness that he saw overwhelming and coming to control Judah in that very period of false security. Secondly, God responded then to Habakkuk in verses 5 through 11 and reveals that amazing, frightening plan of his to turn loose the Chaldeans or Babylonians in judgment against Judah. Well, the next step in the sequence of this unusual prophetic book is for Habakkuk to again address God. As the third part of this conversation, he addresses him a second time, and our text for this mini sub-series is found in that part of the book, in that record of Habakkuk's second address, and that's where we are at this time. Last time we were together, we started this little look at this particular segment of the book of Habakkuk, and remember me telling you that if I had to condense this segment of the conversation coming from Habakkuk, I would simply use four basic words to describe what happens here. Yes, but, why, and nevertheless. Last session, we dealt with Habakkuk's strong and persuasive yes in verse number 12. It is a clear affirmation of Habakkuk's conviction relative to God. And keep in mind that he is affirming, he is offering this affirmation in response to the tragic announcement that God is going to loose the Chaldeans against Judah. Just as God has defined himself in those I am statements in verses 5 through 11, in fact, throughout the entire Word of God, by such terms as I am almighty, I am holy, I am compassionate, I am the first and the last, and on and on. Now Habakkuk speaks back to God and actually is, in this very same manner, affirming back to God with several you are statements. Now, depending on the translation you're using, they may not be literal you are statements, but I feel like that's what Habakkuk was doing. He says, you are the Lord Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel. He declares him to be everlasting, the eternal, no beginning and no ending creator God Elohim. He affirms the sanctity, the purity of God, calling him holy and stating that he is free from contamination by anything that is less than holy and pure. And then Habakkuk addresses him as O Rock. He refers to him as the beginning and the strength of everything that Habakkuk knew God to be. I believe God ordained and directed this text of affirmation, and I want to think of it in that term as a strong message of affirmation in face of pending conflict, not only for Habakkuk himself, but for the people of Judah that would hear it, and for all of us down through the centuries and millennia who continue to hear it. It is a very strong message of affirmation and a lesson for us that we need to continually reaffirm, affirm again, and reaffirm our walk with God. Well, its validity in the day in which you and I live should be easy for us to see, as Peter Drucker pointed out, in this day of ours that is categorized, it's even been categorized that way in prayer tonight, as turbulent and dangerous times. And so Habakkuk now begins his response. He will, so to speak, call God to account. He will be describing his own personal perplexity, speaking out of his horror at what he had just heard, all of these things. And before doing so, his first step, his first action, his priority words were these words of affirmation, the powerful yes that Habakkuk set forth. But that comes next. And then after Habakkuk's affirmation comes his admission in verse number 13. In essence, he said, yes, God, you said it, therefore I believe it. If you say you're loosing the Chaldeans, I believe that. Yes, God, you said it, therefore I believe it, but I cannot say that I understand it. It is the yes, but response of Habakkuk. Now, part of what makes verse 13 meaningful and important and valid is just that strong yes of verse 12, which needed to precede his questions and his admission and his confession. When we first say yes, we have laid a solid foundation for pursuing our buts and our whys. There's no other way for me to express it. When we first say yes, God, you said it, I heard it, I believe it, then we've qualified ourselves for our buts or our whys. The yes needs to be solid, sure, and effusive, loud and strong. And when we give first priority to offering up an affirming yes, notice this, we have qualified our questioning of God by declaring our commitment to God and to His reality. I think that's an important phrase. When we up front offer a strong, valid affirmation of who we see God as being, how we understand God, and how we are committed to God. God, you said it, and I believe it. That qualifies us for the questioning that is to come and clarifies, by clarifying our commission to our commitment to the Lord in the first place. And don't say you don't ever question God. I've heard a mighty lot of you questioning God since November 6. Now, if you're interested in grammar, I'm seeing but here as a conjunction. It's going to introduce something in contrast to what was just said. Synonyms to but would be however, or only, or still, or yet. So you could hear Habakkuk saying, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, Lord, you are Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel. You are Elohim, the eternal creator God of all that has been created. And God, you are holy and without impurity. O God, my rock, my strength, and my beginning. But, or my rock, my strength, and my beginning. However, or my strength and my beginning. Only, or my rock, my strength, and my beginning, still, or my rock, my strength, and my beginning, yet, and then move into the words of verse 13. You see, it isn't a question for Habakkuk of believing in God or even believing God. Habakkuk maintained his belief in God while believing every word pronounced by God about loosing the Chaldeans against Judah. For Habakkuk, it was not an issue of faith or believing. It was an issue of conflicting realities in his mind and heart. Now, verse 13 actually does offer two additional statements of commitments, of commitment and belief. There Habakkuk said, your eyes, God, are too pure to look upon evil. He also says, you cannot, God, tolerate wrongdoing. Those are complimentary of God. Those are expressions from Habakkuk. Well, where did Habakkuk get those words? Where did he get those opinions? Did he deduce those as opinions put together by everything that he knew? Were they based on something stronger like Jewish tradition about God? Wherever and whichever is true, what he hears from God in his pronouncement of judgment conflicts with what he has believed and known about God very personally. Now, it's true. The eyes of God are pure eyes. And the pure eyes of God and the hellish reality of evil contradict each other. Especially they did so in the mind and heart of Habakkuk. And the very thought of holy God tolerating the wrongdoing of the Chaldeans was absolutely impossible for Habakkuk to even fathom. And that brings about Habakkuk's why. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? Punishment of the unrighteous is something that Habakkuk could well understand in Jewish life. Even God using righteous men to punish unrighteous men, that would be comprehensible to Habakkuk as a Jew. But the thought of God using wicked men, wicked Chaldeans, to punish men whom Habakkuk naturally thought, as bad as we are, we're not as bad as they are. That just did not compute in Habakkuk's mind. It did not equate to his own comprehension of God. And so we hear Habakkuk respond, yes, but why? I'm going to let the Lord answer for himself next week. Isn't that big of me? But I am reminded of three things as I studied and prayed about this. Three different biblical incidents came. Let me relate them to you quickly and we'll go. I'm reminded, first of all, of the paradoxical expression of the conflicted father in Mark chapter 9. You know that story. This man whose personal tragedy was different from Habakkuk. It was very personal. It was a son who could not speak because of wicked powers at work within him. And not only that, again and again, this loving father had to watch as he repeatedly convulsed on the ground, foaming at the mouth, wallowing in the dust. And the father is conflicted in this story. He's already asked Jesus' disciples to bring deliverance, and they couldn't do it. And Jesus now said to him, "I can, if you can believe." And you know the classic reply of the father, "I do believe." His very strong, affirming yes. Just like Habakkuk. "I do believe." To that God, to that Jesus, I say yes. I accept that. Followed by his admission, his confession, his conflicting thought. "But help my unbelief." Yes. His answer to Jesus was yes, but he needed Jesus, Emmanuel, God with us, to supply the deficiency, to resolve the conflicts within him, and to make that faith complete. And truth be told, every one of us know this paradox in our lives. It's not politically correct for Christians and preachers and leaders and elders and mature believers like most all of us in this room to admit this, but we all have found ourselves on many occasions at that point of having to say, "Lord, I believe, yes, help thou my unbelief." How the two coexist is a complex issue, but they do, and we should be honest enough with the Lord to admit that. I appreciated Carly's prayer earlier. "Lord, I do not understand, but I do accept your sovereignty." A yes and an admission. "I accept your sovereignty, yes, but I do not understand." I believe that God gives us clear right to approach him in that fashion. And we've all been there where we need to pray, "Lord, I believe, help my unbelief." Then I'm reminded of another time, another place, another man agonizing over another pending judgment, much like Habakkuk. His name is Abraham. The place is the infamous Sodom and Gomorrah. In Genesis chapter 8, God pronounces judgment on the wickedness of that place, and Abraham responded to him with his own form of why. In these words, "Will you sweep away, God, the righteous with the wicked?" That conflicted with how Abraham understood God to be. Read about the process in Genesis 18. How he tries to resolve that conflict with God. "What if there are 50 righteous, God? Or even 45, or 30, or 20, and God forgive me, but what if you can only find 10 righteous people in the city? Will you really sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the righteous? Far be it from you, God." In other words, "That's not the way I know you, God. That doesn't fit your divine profile, to kill the righteous with the wicked, treating them all alike. Will not the judge of the earth ultimately do what's right?" In other words, "I know, God, you're going to do what I think is right." Just doesn't always work out that way. It just doesn't always play out the way we feel like God should do it. God doesn't always accept our evaluation of how things need to be done in our personal lives, in our nation, or in the world around us. And then thirdly, I was drawn to an area of scripture that really is an enumeration of David's mighty men in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. You know, those who came to him at Hebron to turn the kingdom of Saul over to David. It included experienced soldiers and warriors and men who were strong at carrying swords and spears. And right there tucked into verse number 32, you'll find these words. It also included men of Issachar, men who understood the times and knew what Israel should do. And my thought is, how very badly we need such discernment in this turbulent and difficult day in which we live. We need the capacity to discern relative to what is transpiring among the nations. We need a spiritual understanding of the trends and tendencies taking place around us. We need spiritual eyes to see where all of this is leading and who it is who really is in control.